Yes, we're ready to go. Okay, it's 8:45. It is time to begin. As you can see, there are new handouts. The handouts are 6 pages long. They have another reprinting of that Wall Street Journal article, which maybe we'll get to today. And we have 5 questions presented, so we'll try to be efficient. I'll take the questions as well, obviously, as always. But we'll try to actually cover the ground, because after today, we're going to be taking a 2-week break. I know it's not officially announced that way, but I will announce it, and hopefully the COLA will officially follow up as well. I'll be away next Thursday, and I'll be away the following Thursday, but in Yetzer Hashem, plan to return 3 Thursdays from today, so we will resume at that point in time, and we'll take a winter break. So we're going to continue the questions, in which we will cover a little bit about ribbis, a little bit about what we call ribbis pigurim, the enforcement of a bezdin judgment and collection of interest in civil court. How does that play out? We'll talk about the enforcement of rent control laws, Section 8 laws, various landlord-tenant regulations that come from secular court. How do we view that from a Dina de Malchusa Dina perspective? We'll wrap up our discussion regarding injunctive relief and discuss a little bit about real estate contracts from the perspective of halakha and whether recordation rules and land registries and things like that have any impact upon the halakha. So let's start with question number one. Beit Din has issued a decision, but the loser refuses to pay. Can the winner enforce the decision in civil court together with attorney's fees and punitive interest, right? So here we already said that if Beit Din has already issued a judgment, it's probably Shlomo Kluger and the Marashach and lots of post-gim, the preponderance of post-gim, including contemporary post-gim, have come to the conclusion that it is certainly not a slight or an insult to the Bezdin or to the Torah system of law to utilize the secular courts to enforce the Bezdin judgment. We did mention last week that if there is some sort of an appeal claim that one party wants to make, then it makes more sense to have the adjudication of that appeal claim in the context of the Bezdin than in the context of civil court. But if what we're talking about is the shoterim aspect of the Bezdin, right? The Torah says shoftim is shoterim titen lecha, im ein shoter ein shofet, as the Medrash Tanhuma says. If you don't have the police officers and the sheriffs to enforce the Bezdin judgments, then you don't really have a functional Bezdin. So we utilize, that's right, okay, excellent, good example. I'm glad that you have that we have you with us, so you can serve as our enforcer, Rabbi Wiener. So therefore, it makes sense for a party who has received the Bezdin judgment to enforce that judgment in civil court. But the judgment might say that the victor, the zakai, is entitled to $1,000 from the other party. But when they go to court, the court is going to award them additional fees as well. So is that a problem from our perspective? Well, if the additional fees are in the realm of attorney's fees and things of that sort, so presumably that would be covered by the Gemara in Baba Kama that said if you have an individual who's failing to comply with the Bezdin, so we throw the wall at him, right? Remember that Gemara? On Daf Tzadi Beis, Amud Beis of Baba Kama, we throw the wall at that person, and what that effectively means is we throw the book at them, we punish them for the fact that they're not complying with Bezdin. So maybe that's okay from our perspective if there are punitive measures that result from a party refusing to comply in the first instance with the Bezdin. But what about if there was a certain amount that was owing, and now it's a month later, it's 2 months later, it's 6 months later, it's a year later, it's 2 years later, and the court also computes compounded interest with respect to the amount of the judgment. Now, we know that ribbis, interest, is prohibited as a matter of Jewish law. So is this type of interest as well prohibited? Well, if you loan somebody money and you collect interest as a condition of the loan, that's a classical case of biblical interest. If it's not in the context of a loan, so almost any other interest arrangement is going to be at best rabbinic interest. With respect to rabbinic interest, we have a major difference in terms of how it is treated. We say that it's eino yotze b'dayanim. In the event that it was collected, it doesn't have to be returned. So if this is going to be treated as rabbinic interest because it wasn't in the context of a loan, right? And we'll say, okay, maybe it's for interest that the Bezdin wouldn't have authorized itself, but the plaintiff went to court and the plaintiff didn't ask the Bezdin its opinion. Had the plaintiff asked the Bezdin, should I collect the interest parts? And maybe the Bezdin person would have said, nah, you know, that doesn't look so good. Maybe, you know, leave that part alone. But let's say the plaintiff didn't ask, and now the other party to the Din Torah, who lost the Din Torah and now has had the judgment collected from him or her in the civil court, comes to Bezdin and says, well, I want to collect that interest payment back. Maybe the plaintiff had the right to collect everything else, but the plaintiff did not have the right to enforce the judgment in terms of this interest that was not awarded by the Bezdin and should be prohibited according to Jewish law. So presumably the Bezdin would say, well, it's Eino Yosef B'Dayanim. At best, this is only rabbinically prohibited interest, right? In which case, that's not going to be a problem in terms of being able to collect. The only thing is that there is an opinion of Rabbi Akiva Eger. It's in Yoredeya Simen Reish Simach Samach Aleph Sip Katan Hey, on the side of Hilchos Ribbis, where Rabbi Akiva Eger says there's an exception. It's not in the printout, so I'm just giving you the source Baal Peh, where he says that there is an exception to this rule that Avak Ribbis or Rabbinic Ribbis is the Eino Yotzeh B'Dayanim. What's the exception? If it's collected Baal Korcho of the Loveh, if the interest was collected against the will of the other party. Well, here it was definitely collected against the will of the losing party. The losing party didn't want to pay anything, not the principal, not the attorney's fees, and certainly not the court, you know, interest that was imposed. So it might be a problem from the standpoint of Rabbi Akiva.
It's not a loveh.
Well, meaning whether it's the loveh, whether somebody who's classified for purposes of Ribbis Rabbanan as the loveh, as in this case, even though it's not a real loveh. So I knew of a case which one of the Bati Din in New York dealt with a couple of years ago, where they had this very issue, where there was a judgment that was issued by the Beis Din, and the party that won the case went to Beis Din, forced the judgment, collected this interest, and the other party said, I want the interest back, and the Dayanim weren't sure if maybe they should require the collector, the victor of the Beis Din case, and the one who went to court to collect the judgment, whether they should require that party to disgorge this interest amount. So when I had a discussion with one of the Dayanim, I said to one of the Dayanim, because they asked me, they consulted with me, and I said, huh, well, at best it would be Ribbis Drabanan, and it's Eino Yosef B'Dayanim. So I said, yeah, that's what I thought too, but this other rabbi pointed out this Rabbi Akiva Eger to me. So I said, ooh, got me with the Rabbi Akiva Eger. What am I going to do about that? But the truth is, maybe it's not entirely clear, because is it Ribbis Drabanan altogether? Let's first, you know, break this out into two different analyses. One, is it really Ribbis altogether? And second, is there maybe another way of looking at it, even if it is Ribbis Drabanan? So first of all, there is a concept known as a penalty payment, a knas, which is not treated the same as Ribbis. Where, let's say, I loan you money, and I say, I'm not loaning you money for Ribbis. I'm loaning you money, I'm giving you $100 today, and you have to give me back $100 6 months from now. Is there Ribbis there? It doesn't sound like there's Ribbis. I'm loaning you a 0% loan. You have to pay me back interest-free the same amount 6 months later. But I say, however, in the event you don't pay me back on time, I'm letting you pay an interest-free loan, but if you don't pay me back on time, then there's going to be a penalty, a one-time penalty. So say a one-time penalty is not really Ribbis, because I'm not really charging, you know, money, extra, you know, interest for the duration of the loan. I'm just imposing a penalty. So because of the fact that it looks like interest, so we say that it's also on a Derabbanan level. Rabbinically, it's going to be prohibited. Let's say it's not in the context of a loan. It's in the context of a sale. I say, I'm selling you an object, and you have to pay me for this merchandise within the next 6 months. But if you don't pay me in 6 months, then I'm going to impose a one-time fee, a one-time penalty payment upon you. So then that is considered to be heter gamur. That's 100% permissible, because since it's not even in the context of a loan transaction, it doesn't even smack of interest. It's obviously a penalty fee. However, that's only if it's a one-time penalty fee. But if it's a knas hamisrabeh, knas hamisrabeh rolls off the tongue, that is a compounded interest. So compounded means that you are, it's not a one-time penalty payment, but you're actually computing interest over time. You're saying, okay, it's going to grow every single month. For every single month of delay that you're not paying, it's going to become a larger and larger amount, computed at 2%, 4%, 6%. So when the courts impose a punitive interest, so a person not paying the amount that they're supposed to pay on time, they don't impose a one-time penalty fee. They impose impose compounded interest. Compounded interest is going to be more problematic because that, the way that we paskin in Shulchan Aruch, the way it's understood by the Shulchan Aruch Harav, the Baal HaTanya, even if you have a non-loan transaction, if it is stipulated that if the money's not paid on time, there's going to be a compounded penalty payment calculated based on an interest rate, that is going to be prohibited even though it's in the context of a penalty payment. So then, we're back to square one on some level. We still have a potential problem in these cases. However, there's an article in an Israeli Torah journal, which is a collection of psukim and articles by the Dayanim who sit in the major Bate Din in Eretz Yisrael. It's called Shura Sadin. So in one of the volumes of Shura Sadin, there's an article by Rabbi Mordechai Rabag. I believe that Rabbi Mordechai Rabag, who sometimes publishes in Tuchumen, you're familiar, you see the journal over there, the multicolored volumes on the second shelf from the top in the middle over there. So in Tuchumen, Rabbi Mordechai Rabag, he often publishes articles, and he's a dayan, I believe, at this point in time, for the Beis Din HaGadol in Yerushalayim. He's a very, very high-ranking dayan, so he wrote an article in the Shura Sadin about this particular subject, and he says that he consulted with the author of a sefer called Nesiva Shalom. Nesiva Shalom is one of the major contemporary works on Hilchos Ribbis. It's written by Rabbi Yober. And he spoke to this Rabbi Yober about precisely this type of situation. He says, forget whether it's a Drabbanan case, Daraisa case, a loan is made. Or there's an obligation which is outstanding. And the person who is supposed to pay the obligation has not paid the obligation. And now the creditor comes along and he seizes the amount of the obligation, plus he takes an additional amount. This additional amount was not stipulated or anything, and it's taken against the will of the other party. The other party, you know, your normal ribbis situation is where you have a borrower who says, yeah, I agree to the terms of this transaction. I'll pay you a premium for the loan that you're making me. There's no agreement here. The person, the creditor, is just taking an extra amount against the will, bal korcho, of the other party. Is that considered to be ribbis? And this is completely in the context of if a party didn't pay a judgment and the other one takes them to court and they have court-imposed interest, which is taken from the other party, the non-paying party, against their will. Is that really considered to be ribbis altogether? And said Rabbi Gelber, no, I don't think that's ribbis altogether. You know what that is? That's gezel. It's gezel. It's theft. But it's not ribbis. It's not ribbis. And he bases this on a Ramban that's quoted by the Beis Yosef in Hilchos Ribbis, where the Ramban says something very similar. The Ramban says that if the currency of a country is changed from the time a loan is made and from until the time the loan is collected, and now the lender comes along and he collects, you know, the amount of money that he loaned only with this currency, which is worth a lot more, but that's the new currency. You know, it's the same, it's called the same thing. Shkolem before, shkolem now. It's, you know, were ducats before and it's ducats now. He is collecting that newly minted currency, which is worth a lot more. So based on Dina de Malchus Adina, he can get away with it. And the Ramban says that that's not ribbis. At best, it would be gezel, but it's not gezel because it's authorized by the government, because they've minted these new coins and they've said these count as the coins from now on. So therefore, he says, if you can somehow get rid of the gezel, then you'll be in good shape. How could you get rid of the gezel? If the Beis Din would say, technically speaking, if the Beis Din would say, we give permission to the person who was victorious in the Din Torah case in front of the Beis Din to enforce the judgment in court, and you can collect whatever the court gives you. Court wants to pay you interest fees. Gegus and hey, you can collect the interest fees. We're throwing the wall, and the figurative wall, as it were, at this other party for not respecting the Beis Din. So you can go collect it. So now we've already said it's not ribbis because it's against the will. We're not, you know, assuming like Rabbi Akiva Eger over here. And it is not gezel because the Beis Din is authorizing it. So the author, Rabbi Mordechai Rabag, then turned to none other but who do you ask questions when you want to find out what the absolute, you know, official halakhic truth is nowadays? Who do you go to? You go to Rav Chaim Kanievsky. So he went to Rav Chaim Kanievsky and he asked him, what do you think about this situation? So he quotes Rav Chaim Kanievsky, said, I agree that it wouldn't be a problem of ribbis, it would only be a problem of gezel, and if the Beis Din authorizes it, then it wouldn't even be gezel, but you still shouldn't do it. A Beis Din shouldn't authorize it. Why not? Because it's nearer to ribbis. Because it's going to look to people like ribbis. And you don't want to do things that look like ribbis, even though they're not actually ribbis. The Gemara has this concept in a number of different places. One of the concerns is, Dilma, see the misracha, that people will make a mistake that they will get used to being comfortable with ribbis, and they'll think even in other situations where it's not, where it really is ribbis, that it would be permissible. So therefore, it's not something that we should encourage or endorse. Okay, I'll now take questions.
If it's permitted, would be permitted because of Hefsker Beskin's to let the other the civil court do whatever it wants.
Presumably, yeah. On some level.
Does Daimler Bog think that that's Pshat Rabbi Akiva Eiger?
He doesn't discuss Rabbi Akiva Eiger. He does admit that there are Achronim. He admits that the Chavis Daz doesn't agree with this, so he admits that this is not the view of all the Achronim, but it's his opinion that this is reflective of the view of the Ramban, so therefore he's not bothered if an Achron or two, you know, might not subscribe to this notion. Yes?
If the value of money decreases over a given period of time, and it's only this guy's refusal to pay, right, which has effectively, $60 now is not $60 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So now you have like a case of Chota and Niskar because he's not paying the true value of what he's been holding out on.
That's why you have to be careful who you loan money to and who you enter into transactions with, right? You know, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach has a very interesting and somewhat puzzling tshuva in the Mincha Shlomo, in which he suggests that the other way around, the opposite sort of conclusion of what we're discussing, says that it could be that rather than the creditor forcibly taking this extra amount as a penalty amount to compensate him from the Lobe, if the Lobe decides on his own, it's really terrible how I've treated the Malbec. I forced him to suffer so much by not paying on time. There was no stipulation of paying an extra amount, but the Lobe says, you know what, I'm going to compensate you for all of your loss and all of your misery and the fact that I deprived you of this money for a period of time. So he suggests that maybe that would be okay. That's considered to be a little bit of a startling finish on the part of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, but it's kind of like coming from the other direction and addressing your concern.
It's
right.
Still there.
Yeah. It would appear that would still... Most people look at that and say, isn't that ribbis? Right, which is why I said it's startling and puzzling. But I'm quoting it anyway because it's there. Right?
When you raised the original question, you raised it in the context of the guy recovering the money after he already paid it because it was illegal ribbis. Now you come to the conclusion that it's not even a matter of taking it back, that it's mutter to give it to him to begin with.
I'm quoting it because none of this is consistent with Rabbi Akiva Eiger, but since it's in an article by an esteemed Dayan, I'm quoting it, and he has other very honorable people whom he's quoting as well.
Okay, regardless who you're quoting, I'm just saying it changed from an after-the-fact issue to now a before-the-fact thing that he's allowed to collect it in the first
place.
Except
they all say no. They all say that even though you might make an argument that if it's taken against the will and was never stipulated up front, remember, that's why it didn't start off as ribbis, and it's taken against the will of this individual, they say that if it's authorized by the Besdin, so maybe then not only have you avoided the ribbis issue, but you've avoided the Gezel issue, okay? However, they all say it's mere ribbis, you shouldn't do it anyway. But Rabbi Gelber says, what if I have the following case? I have a case of a deadbeat dad. I have a deadbeat dad. And he's supposed to be paying amounts, and a Besdin had issued a decision. He's supposed to be supporting his children, paying child support, supposed to be paying marital support, and his wife and his ex-wife and his children are languishing terribly, and he's not paying the amounts. And now the wife says, I've gone a year without this child support, and I'm suffering in abject poverty, and I want to be able to collect the amounts that the Besdin awarded me. So says Rabbi Gelber, in this particular case, he says, I'll quote from him, because I don't want to misrepresent him. He says, also, you'll think I'm making this whole thing up. Rai l'chora, l'hadif, Toba Saisha Viladeha, Aal Chashash Zeb, Shel Ribis, the Aal Yishtamshu, Ose Abla, Betanos, Shein Bohem, Mamish Minadin. He says that it is better to be considerate of the needs of this poor woman and her poor children, rather than to be concerned about something which is not reflective of the actual halacha, because the actual halacha is that this is not really ribbis. So he says that in extreme situations, a Besdin would actually have the discretion not only, to decide that they're not going to require somebody who received this court-mandated ribbis pigurim, interest on an obligation, not to require them to give it back, but even to allow them to collect it in the first instance. So it gives you just a sense of the range of views about this. This is a hot topic right now. It's a hot topic. It's called, you know, Hotzah Lepoel. There's a lot of discussion about the parameters of enforcing Beis Din judgments in court, what you can do, what you can't do. One of the major issues that is focused upon is precisely this type of situation, court-mandated interest. To what extent is it problematic? So we've given the spectrum here from Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who would indicate that even if it's only at the Rabbanan level, it's more problematic than normal Ribbis to Rabbanan, to Rabbi Gelber, who indicates that if a Beis Din author, and Rabbi Gelber is the author of Nesiva Shalom, which is a very respected volume in Hilchos Ribbis, that if the Beis Din authorizes it, so then it could actually become mutter even l'chatzchila. So it's just, again, it doesn't come up so much, because what happens, practically speaking, in most cases in Beis Din, is that once the Beis Din issues the judgment, the Beis Din is done with the case. And then it expects the parties to comply. If a party doesn't comply, and the other party takes them to civil court, so the Beis Din is fine with that. The Beis Din doesn't interfere so much. If somebody would ask a question, oh, can I collect extra interest or not? So then, you know, that's something the Beis Din might want to deal with. I will give you a question that was posed to me along these lines, which is a very, very interesting question, and where I actually have a printed source in the materials that we can focus upon to see exactly how you might want to deal with this question. Yes?
You said before it's okay to have a penalty if a person doesn't pay on time, one-time penalty.
That's if it's a non-loan transaction.
Right,
so loan transaction, we prohibit that, even that means rabbanan.
Right, but what if I want to buy something and there's a discount if I pay by a certain time? Is that...
That's a totally different question that has to do with Hilchos Ribbis. Generally speaking, discounts are problematic, okay, from the perspective of halacha, because the assumption is that, you know, then you're paying extra for the extra time, or maybe if you're not getting the merchandise right away, so then the merchandise itself is being given to you at a discounted price based on Ribbis. Discounts are very, very complicated. If it's through a Tzedaka institution, we're a little bit more lenient because it's probably only Ribbis to Rabbanan, and with Tzedaka institutions and yeshivas and the like, they're allowed to engage, generally speaking, in Ribbis to Rabbanan. That's based on a Gemara. And in certain types of cases where the service is received immediately, where it kicks in immediately, so then it might not be viewed quite as a discount. It might be viewed as a tit-for-tat transaction, which would be okay. It's a complicated question, not the subject for today, but a very, very good question. But discounts, you should, if you have a discount situation, the most important thing you need to know is that it is inherently problematic, so that at least a shaila needs to be asked, because very often it's going to be a problem. Okay? Now.
Can I understand you from the Tzedek? Chaim Kessy would say that it would be okay if the Lova on his own would want to give extra.
No, but Shlomo Zalman Orbach suggests that. That's the Mincha Shlomo. Chaim Kanievsky didn't deal with that. Chaim Kanievsky said that if you collect a punitive interest amount that wasn't stipulated, of course, you know, let's say a court mandated amount, against the will of the other parties, he says that's not Ribbis. Ribbis is something which is willingly stipulated or willingly paid. You know, he says that's not Ribbis. It's Gezel, but it's not Ribbis. And if the Beis Din mandates it, so it's not Gezel either, but it still shouldn't be mandated because it's Nirek Ribbis, just because it looks like Ribbis. That's the totality of how he is quoted.
Okay, but in the case where the Lova on his own offers.
That's a question. So
that
some would
say that that's Ribbis?
So I think that the pashtus is that's Ribbis. It's certainly it's Ribbis there, right? So when it's stipulated up front. And remember, we have all these cases where, let's say, a Lova decides after the fact they're going to give a matana. They're going to give a gift to the Malva in appreciation for the loan that was extended. We say that that also is in the realm of Ribbis. It looks like Ribbis. It is some type of a penumbra of Ribbis, and therefore that's prohibited at the Rabbanan level. It's hard to distinguish the case of Matana, where we say that a Matana Milcheris, or a Matana Mugdemis, is given by a Lova to a Malva, meaning a Matana before the fact or after the fact, but we say that's not permitted on a rabbinical level. So why, if he says, I'm not giving it as a Matana, I'm giving it to you to compensate you for your trouble that you had to wait so long for me to pay back, and you lost earnings, you know, during that period of time. Why is that better? It's a big kasha. That's one of the reasons why this statement or suggestion of the Mincha Shlomo is problematic. It's a problematic suggestion, but I'm just mentioning it because it's part of kind of this larger discussion. It's something to be nichnas b'tocha cheshba, right? Something to take into consideration.
Before or after, not
what?
Mukdemis
is before or after, and even then it's problematic.
Right.
Even then it's problematic. here as well. It's, and here you could say it's not even before or after. He's giving back the money. He says, oh, and by the way, in addition to giving back the money, here's, you know, something a little bit extra for your troubles. So that sounds like actual ribbis. It sounds like actual ribbis. Right. Okay. No, it wasn't stipulated. Okay.
Not stipulated.
And he's also not giving it as ribbis. He's giving it to compensate. You know. So therefore, Rav Shlomo Zalman thought it's something to consider as maybe that would be okay. As I said, I'm not defending that position. I am reciting that position. I'm conveying that position. You can look at it inside in the Mincha Shlomo. I have the Mara Makom, not in front of me the second, but I can get you the Mara Makom. It's in this book. Okay. So I can turn to the page. Okay. Now let's look at.
Be a service fee, basically.
What?
If it's mukdemet, wouldn't it be a service?
No, it's not a. Again, you can be cute about ribbis and call things service fees, but lemaisa, if it's in return for the fact that you're receiving a loan and you're giving, being given an extension of time to pay it, we call it ribbis. And even if a person calls an extension fee, that doesn't, or a service fee, that doesn't change the reality of the transaction. We look at the substance. We don't, you know, necessarily base ourselves on the form or the term that's used by the parties. Now, if you look in the Chidushei HaRitba, okay, it's the source Aleph, okay, he talks about a very interesting halakha. He says, Mutar la'adam, the halvos, levanam nebeso beribis, de latim and tam ribis. Don't worry, we're going to get rid of this permission by the time we're done. But we start off by saying that a person can play around with his little kids because it's all his money. So he gives them his money, and he's going to take back some money with ribbis. But, you know, since the money doesn't really belong to them anyway, he's just really giving the money to himself and taking it back to himself because there are only little kids in his house. So he should just, he does it this way so they could see how annoying it is to have to give back more than what they initially had received. And he's allowed to do this so that they'll realize how bad ribbis is, how pernicious ribbis is. Says the Ritva, we're talking about obviously little kids who are still eating at his table, because whatever they're giving him extra, the little allowances, it's all his money anyway, so therefore it doesn't really count as ribbis. And it's to teach them a lesson so they'll know not to get involved with ribbis. The Gemara concludes, says the Rit, first the Gemara Bamasiya Dafayane, that it's Asa Duma Asa the Misaf, that's how we pass. You're not allowed to do it because once they get involved with ribbis, they'll say, hey, if this can work to hurt me, maybe this can also work to help me. Bahavi Yodea. So then the Rit just throws in and he says, I have not seen this codified halacha, but I have not seen anybody reject this ritva either. So this is a very interesting ritva because it relates to our type of situation and a specific shayla that was posed to me. He says, "V'habi yodeya shim haya lo etzel chaveo gezel lochov." Let's say I know that a particular person stole money from me or borrowed money from me and never returned it. 10 years ago. Okay, this happened a long time ago and he's not paying me back. And now he comes to me and he says, can you please loan me some money? Okay? Let's say I have Yitzchak, Gezel Chav Sheinu Batuach, Mutal Avos Lo. So now I can loan money. This person owes me $50. He owes me $50 of money that he stole to me or a different debt that he never paid up. So now I can loan to him $100 and say, I'm giving you $100, and when you pay me back 3 months from now, I want you to pay me back not $100, but $150. Mutal Avos Lo, Amanashi Parlo, Oso Gezel Ochov. I will loan you this money on condition that you will pay me back the additional $50 that you owe me as well. She'en kan ribbis klal. So this is also, this is not considered to be ribbis. Similar to the case that we mentioned that would have been mutter about loaning money and taking back money for ribbis from your little children because all the money is yours anyway. So he says here too, this should be permissible. You know why this should be permissible? Because the money is yours anyway. To mind the most play love we did day of the Ireland is that borrower. This is clear. It is obvious. So he says that this would be perfectly fine. So now here's the question.
But that's a service.
That's not a service at all. This is, he's collecting additional monies that were owed to him, but he's doing it in the context of a loan transaction. Otherwise, this party wouldn't have paid him back. But he's essentially stipulating ribbis on this loan in order to be able to receive the other money that this party owes him. For whatever reason, the Ritva feels that we don't have to worry in this case about Dilma Asi Lemisrach. Now, why is it the Ritva is not worried about Dilma Asi Lemisrach? Because here, everybody knows what the score is, right? Everybody knows what the deal is. The person who's giving me the extra $50 knows that even if it's set up as Ribbis, it looks like Ribbis, he knows it's not Ribbis because he owes me the money anyway. I know it's not Ribbis since we both know what the deal is over here. It's not really Ribbis. So we don't have to worry about Dilma Asi Lemisrach. So let's say I have parties who adjudicate a case in Bezdin. Bezdin rules that Reuven is obligated to pay Shimon $1,000. Reuven didn't pay the money. Now Shimon wants to go to civil court to collect the $1,000, okay? But for whatever reason, there are different aspects of the obligation that the Bezdin has ruled upon, and the civil court will hold that for public policy reasons, they're only going to enforce $800 of this obligation. The other $200 have to do with stuff that's beyond their purview of being able to enforce. For whatever reason, it violates antitrust, or let's assume some other reason that they feel they won't be able to enforce it. Or it was even a child support obligation, but they feel that they're not going to be able to enforce it because it was too much, according to their guidelines. So now Shimon wants to go to the court, and he says, you know what, the court will only enforce $800, but the court will also give me court-imputed interest on the amount that hasn't been paid up until now. They'll compound the interest. It's going to add up very, very quickly. The $800, once they add on the imputed court interest, it's going. They're going to add on another $200. I'll get my $1,000 anyway. Can I be allowed to do that? So based on this Ritva, it would seem that the Bezdin can probably authorize Shimon to do that. Because Shimon knows that he's not really collecting any interest, right? And Reuven knows that the amount that's being extracted in the end is the amount that the Bezdin was mechayev him to pay, and not really the Ribbis amount. So therefore, this would be an application of where Bezdin could actually authorize such a thing, even if you were normally worried about Rabbi Akiva Eger, even if you were worried about Rabbi Chaim Kanievsky's concerned about Nira Karibis, and it wasn't a situation where you had to help a poor divorcee and poor children, that you could still potentially rely upon this. I was asked a slightly different variation of this question, where there was a case where a Bezdin authorized, Reuven wanted to bring Shimon to Bezdin for a claim of, say, approximately $1,000, and Shimon refused. In other words, there was no judgment from Bezdin. We don't know if Reuven would have prevailed in Bezdin or not, but Bezdin gave a heter to Reuven to pursue the case in a civil court. And now Reuven wants to know, says that had I pursued the case in Bezdin, I would have been able to pursue this full $1,000, okay, which I feel is owing to me. But if I go to court, I'll only be able to pursue about $800 of the claim. That's all that the court will give me. On the other hand, the obligation is such that I will be able to claim in the court, number one, that Shimon owes me the $800 that should have been paid 2 years ago, and that there should be imputed interest compounded over the time from when the debt should have been paid, and as a result, I'll be able to pick up $1,000. So can I be allowed, am I allowed to do it under those circumstances? So I said, I think that is a harder question. The reason why it's a harder question is because Bezdin hasn't yet adjudicated the case. So Bezdin has not objectively determined that Reuven is entitled to that entire $1,000. From Shimon's perspective, Shimon might view that interest as real interest, and not as a clear gezel or chob that has to be paid up. So therefore, here, you might have to be a little bit more worried about the Dilma Asi Lemisrach consideration. I don't know that as a Bezdin, I would feel comfortable authorizing the collection, the chatchila, of interest in that case. Again, if the person did it without asking Bezdin, that might be a different story after the fact. But if you're asking before the fact, and somebody actually came over to me, can you imagine the type of questions that we get? So I actually got this question, and I came to the conclusion that, Sarek Ian, I'm not sure, but I think that the case where the Bezdin already issued the judgment, the case that I gave you, I think that that more clearly fits within the parameters of the Ritva, or at least Lechaira, it seems to more clearly fit within the parameters of the Ritva.
Suppose we're in the case where the Bezdin is a gezel, so it sounds like he's saying that if the stipulation was that he would pay that amount, that, then it won't be a problem. He said that's his pashut.
True. I mean, that is the formulation of the Ritva, but Lemaise, the person is not giving back this money other than in the context of the loan that he is receiving. Okay. So therefore, whatever you're going to call it, it looks like your typical Ribbis transaction. I am giving you some a certain amount of money. You're giving me back more money. Okay.
But like you said, a regular Ribbis transaction is that he's not entitled to the extra money.
And in the court case,
but by the Chov and Gezel, he's entitled. I'm just going to give it to you.
And in the court case as well. In the court case as well, he's entitled to it. And they're not stipulating a Ribbis transaction up front. He's just going to court to collect his money.
Right.
Right. So therefore, that's why I think that the cases are more analogous than not.
Okay. So interest calculations usually come to what amounts? It's hard to imagine that it comes to exactly $200. So suppose
if it comes to less, it's going to be a problem.
If it comes to
right?
less, but what if it comes to a little more? What if it's $300 rather than $200?
So then he would have to just give the extra amount back to Shimon in the end and say, okay, Shimon, I'm sorry, I collected too much. You know, I really only needed $1,000. The Bezdin only gave me $1,000. I got from the court $1,100. Here's the extra $100. Show him how you saw. Right. Again, yes, it's difficult practically to see how this plays out in practice. But again, you're dealing with scrupulous people who want to follow the halakha, so yes. It's not inconceivable to me that people who really want to follow the halakha carefully would do this. Remember, the type of people who are asking me the shilos are the type of people who really would carry it out according to the instruction of the Beis Din. Good. So we've covered question number one. Excellent. Now, what if... We even covered question number two. What do you know? So we just did question number two as well. What if Bezdin did not issue a decision and authorize the plaintiff to bring action in civil court against the counsel the defendant refused to submit to Bezdin? Is the plaintiff allowed to claim interest payments or outstanding obligations? We just covered it. Very good. Okay, now, question number three. A case is brought to Bezdin by a landlord who wishes to raise his tenant's rent or else evict the tenant, but according to rent control laws, the landlord would not be able to carry through this course of action. Does rent control law matter from the perspective of the Bezdin? And remember, what was our standard that we pointed out that the post can follow in terms of when we incorporate Dina de Malchus to Dina into our system? It's when the Malchus is mocked,
really
right? You think the Malchus really cares about the enforcement of rent control laws?
Yes.
According to our standard, I hear a resounding, unequivocal yes, okay? That then the Bezdin would be duty-bound to apply the laws. Interestingly, when Ramosha Feinstein was asked about this question, this is in source number two, he discusses a great length. He says, I don't even have to get into the entire Dina de Malchus to Dina question. Remember, we said maybe this was an early thing, he didn't want to get into that whole area altogether. But he said that he thinks that this is covered through a different principle of Minhag HaMedina. What's a Minhag HaMedina means that when landlords and tenants enter into contracts, there's an expectation that they're going to follow what the norms are that are in place. And if the norms in this type of building is that the things are done in accordance with rent control, that you can only charge so much rent, and then if the tenant is prepared to stay, then you have to keep the tenant for as long as the tenant is prepared to pay whatever is the statutory amount of rent control for that building. So then you have to comply. There's no question. Says Ramosha, the only time that Dina de Malchusa would come into the picture is if these various laws and regulations didn't exist at the time in which the contract was entered into, and that they only were introduced afterwards. So it wasn't part of the contractual arrangement, or maybe the rent control laws changed, that they became more favorable towards the tenant or something like that after the time that the contract was entered into. So then we can't say that it's a matter of Minhag HaMedina, that this is an implied part of the contract, but rather then we would have to apply Dina de Malchusa, and he doesn't say one way or another whether we would definitely come to that conclusion.
Minhag HaMedina, where you have tenant organizations, landlord organizations, lobbying a board that can vote again. It's not a set minhag. It's something that they struggle with every, whatever the law, to get it changed. It's not established and accepted by, hey, this is what we've been doing.
Well, I think it is, meaning that if all the landlords and all the tenants are going along with this, and all the tenants have the expectation that the landlord is going to comply with this, oh, you mean that if they're struggling with it and everything, the minhag is that everybody violates it. That's what
you're saying.
So that would be a different story according to Ramosha. Now, trying to change it is different than not going along with it. But if everybody is actually going along with it, then the assumption is that even though you'd like to change it over time, but at this point in time, you're going along with what is customary around you. So that's what Ramosha says over here. That is the thrust of his tshuva. Okay? And therefore he says, based on Minhag HaMedina, everybody understands that you're Yashi Yaseh, Minhag HaMedina, that you're always going to follow according to the Minhag HaMedina. But you're right. Let's say that this is a city, a particular locale, where there are Jewish landlords and Jewish tenants, and for whatever reason, I'm not saying that such a place exists anywhere, but let's say, a place existed where everyone knew that nobody's following the law. And this is the expectation, the tenant moves in, Section 8, Section Shmeit, it doesn't really matter, everyone knows that you pay whatever the landlord asks you to pay, and it's more than whatever the rent control law is, more than whatever Section 8 says he's allowed, that's the law in the books in New York City, whatever the if it's more than what the landlord's allowed to charge, it doesn't matter. That's the amount that we pay. That's what everybody does. So it could be that if that's the minhag, that even if it's not in accordance with the law, but if the whole binding force of the law is based on whatever the minhag is, so then if the minhag is, then nobody follows it. So presumably the Bezdin would have to take that into consideration according to Rav Moshe. Take a look at Rav Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, and this is very, very powerful stuff. Rav Henkin, remember, was the reigning posek in America in the late 20th century prior to when Rav Moshe really emerged on the scene, okay? Rav Henkin was really the big posek for many, many years. And Rav Henkin wrote a lot about this whole subject of Dina D'Malchusa, Dina and the like, and he says some really astounding things that is not the lingo necessarily that you would expect from the reigning postgame of nowadays, because he wrote in a different style, but it's still very, very interesting. He says, and we have to really reconsider whether this changes for us. I apologize because this was not on Bar Ilan CD-ROM. It's on Hebrew books. And therefore, I had to type it. Okay? I could not cut and paste. So there are some typos here and there. This Marav Makom, She'en Li Yisrael, but they didn't clue him into Be'ayir. Nowadays, that we don't really have regular set Bate Din. Now, he was writing this before the CRC obviously became such a force in the world, and other Bate Dins became such a force in the world. We have to revisit whether this is really true. He's saying that part of the job of the elders of the city, the Zion Tuba Yair, the Bate Din, is to make monetary takanos that people will follow in the city, including takanos that govern the relationships between landlords and tenants. Really, that's something that the Bezdin should do with the Jewish community. But he's saying that's not the reality in America. Maybe we should think about making that the reality in America, but we haven't. And all of the laws of general economic betterment for society are enacted by the government. Then everybody has to follow those laws. And when the case comes to Bezdin, the Bezdin also is duty-bound to follow those laws. Constitutionalist. And certainly if you have a constitutional system like the United States, you see, I don't really see this term constitutional, at least transliterated in this fashion, in many of the tshuvas you read nowadays, but it matters to him. We're dealing with a constitutional democracy where everybody gets to weigh in, the non-Jews, the Jews, right? You know, we have Joe Lieberman, people like that in the Senate. We're also involved in this process, and therefore it is a collective process of when the rent control laws are put on the books, they're put by everybody on the books. Anakmi Yoshe, next paragraph. Anakmi Yoshe, Atzos Vist America, Shechukem, Nasim, Aidea, Nivkorem, Bechore, Ezrochem, Acharameka, Komemkar, Shepeshe, Bineem, Shalacetic, Mishpa, Nasim, everything is done in a just fashion. We don't have this type of institution, so therefore, so their laws, their societal laws of sweeping economic enactments that are for the betterment of society, like bankruptcy laws, rent control laws, things like that, they're automatically incorporated by us into Dina D'Malchusa Dina, because we really should be doing this stuff. We're not powerful enough or organized enough to do it, so therefore when they do it, it's considered like they're doing it for us as well. Even though it's not always according to the details of the Shulchan Aruch, if they are the things that are followed by the rest of the country, that is the minhag that we have to go, that we have to follow. Shabbat, Dava, Eitzel, Dayana, Yisrael. And when these matters come in front of our Bate Din, Shrikam, Lipsok, Abiku, Kam, Chutz, Medina, Yerushos, and he makes the exception of Yerushos, so that's obviously the nod that has to be made in deference to that flaming shuva of the Rashba that we saw a number of weeks ago, where the Rashba was talking about a Yerusha situation, so he's not getting himself into trouble when it comes to Yerusha, so he gives the Yerusha exception. So then he specifically speaks about this case, Chok Adiros, rent control laws, Shalom Mishalah Hu Yasher, Mesukan, they're really just, and they're really equitable, and they're really nice laws that are looking out for the little guy. You know, we believe in that, right? The proper Aram HaGadolos, especially in big cities like Chicago, New York, because it's meant to prevent people from, it's meant to control the slumlords, and you know the people are going to take advantage of the poor folks. And even though sometimes it's hard for the landlords, Shane and Mashim, especially those landlords who are not so rich, sometimes people get hurt a little bit, but if it's for the overall good of society, then we have to go along with it. That in which we have these rent control buildings which are giving special preference, that's a good thing for society as a whole. Turn the page. And yes, it's true, as Rabbi Rina said, people sometimes look to change the rent control laws from time to time. It doesn't matter. It's all part of what we go along with. He says, therefore, we have to follow basically their laws and regulations when it comes to these particular matters. And again, he emphasizes and emphasizes again, re-emphasizes in the last paragraph that a lot of this has to do with the fact that this is really our responsibility. Our communal institutions, our Bati Din, our elders are supposed to be instituting these types of laws and enactments for the betterment of our society, for the poor and the vulnerable and the weak and the defenseless and so forth. But if we don't get our act together and we're not doing it, and it's being done by the country at large, this constitutional country in which we all play a part, then it is incumbent upon us to go along with it as well. So Rav Henkin clearly goes further than Rav Moshe. The difference will be, according to Rav Henkin, if you follow his approach, and I think I've heard from Rav Schechter a number of times that he has invoked Rav Henkin's approach favorably in the context of bankruptcy law as well. That if, in fact, we are not serving that function of instituting these types of laws, then we have an obligation to go along with these laws of economic regulation that are promulgated by the society at large. And that would therefore apply even to a situation where, let's say, it was a vicinity where nobody was really keeping the laws. I mean, I had a case once in which there was a Section 8 landlord-tenant lease between the landlord and the tenant, and the argument before the Beis Din was that everybody knew that, of course, the tenant was supposed to be paying more than what the law requires. I mean, come on, don't you know anything? This is, you know, yeah, technically it's the books, but, you know, we don't quite do that 100%. And they wanted to enforce whatever was the understanding between the parties. So we felt uncomfortable going along with that, and part of what we said was that in addition to Ramosha's consideration, that there's an implied understanding when you go into such a lease that you're following whatever is the practice of society around you, even if you want to argue that nobody in your particular vicinity was following this, Dina de Machusa is applicable, particularly when it comes to these types of regulations that are meant to help out the little guy. You know why? Because we, as a Beis Din entity, are supposed to look out for the little guys too. And therefore, if they wouldn't be doing it, we would have to be doing it. And since we're not doing it, we have to go along with their laws. I also threw in, because I've done my own independent Dina de Machusa analysis, as you know, that if we would issue a judgment to the contrary, in which we would completely violate and ignore the rent and landlord-tenant laws that are out there for the protection of poor tenants that are promulgated by society, we could get into a lot of trouble. And therefore, since it is also something in which the Malchus is a Makpedis, that's something that we know that the government really cares about, therefore, for that reason as well, based on the definition that we have outlined, I also felt that it falls into the ambit of Dina de Machus Adina. My fellow Dayanin agreed with me, and therefore we issued a psak along those lines. Okay?
I think you're not saying because it's not good. You're saying he says that there's a minus to the Dina Machus of America in that we're all
That's what Henkin says. I'm introducing the Makrid. I'm just saying that's a third consideration. It's the Moshe's consideration of the Minhag of Medina. Even if that's not applicable, so there's the Dina de Malchusa consideration of a Henkin. We're all in this together. It's almost like a shukvus on some level. And then there's the third consideration that I hold, that if the Malchus is Makrid, so that also makes it into a Dina de Malchusa Dina that gets incorporated if it is the Takanis B'nai Medina, as the Ramah articulates in Kosher Mishpat Simon Shin Samach Tes. Case number four. Okay, we're making progress. A school principal files for emergency injunctive relief. We've discussed this already. Remember? Who were the sheetahs that we quoted when it came to filing for injunctions? Anybody remember? We quoted Ramosha. What did Ramosha say? Good, bad, indifferent? Said injunctions, okay. You can file for injunctions. Not considered to be a violation of our cause. Because you're not litigating the case. You're just getting temporary relief that the Beis Din can't afford you anyway. And then there was Rabosner. Rabosner said, no, you got to go through a Beis Din process to make sure that it's warranted. And we pointed out, maybe Rabosner was only speaking about, in the context of Eretz Yisrael, in a case where the rabbinical court already has a certain amount of jurisdiction anyway, but if you wouldn't have the jurisdiction, then Ramosha's perspective would win out. So what happens here? This is a case that happened to me. School principal files, meaning that the case came to our business attention a number of years ago. When emergency injunctive relief, the principal said, I'm about to be fired. The yeshiva he worked for 10, 15 years was going to get rid of him, and he's going to lose access to all his files and papers, and he needs emergency relief from the Bezin. Because he feels he is about to be fired and expelled from his office, and he'll lose access to his files. Should the Bezin grant the relief or authorize him to file for injunctive relief in the civil courts? Similarly, a different type of case where somebody comes to the Beis Din, we're dealing with a divorce case, and the wife says, I'm afraid that my husband is going to hurt me. Am I allowed to go to criminal court to file for an order of protection against my husband? Well, if the Beis Din is asked by a wife, she could file for an order of protection against an abusive husband, and the Beis Din has not done its independent investigation as to whether what she's saying is truthful. Maybe her husband is not abusing her, right? Okay, so I'm lumping the two together, but we don't have to necessarily address them in the same fashion. What do you think?
Second word is pikuach nefesh.
Might be pikuach nefesh. So the answer to both of them is that you allow it, but you allow it in a way in which it does not prejudice the Beis Din. If the Beis Din would issue injunctive relief, and I mentioned this in the past, in ex parte fashion, when the Beis Din doesn't really have jurisdiction over the parties, so then the other party against whom it is issued will not respect the Beis Din's injunction, because they'll say, who are you to issue this injunction against me? I never was mekabel your samkut. So therefore, here, it's better for the Beis Din to say, we can't adjudicate the case until we have samkut, we have jurisdiction over the case. If it's a monetary type of claim, and there is a signed arbitration agreement, the Beis Din would say, we're going to call both parties in on an emergency basis, maybe even do a conference call, and determine whether injunctive relief is appropriate, because we get to make that call. But if it's a criminal case, the Beis Din doesn't even get to make that call, because the Beis Din doesn't have criminal jurisdiction. So what the Beis Din does is a classic if-then statement, meaning if any party, okay, not you in particular, or the party that came to us in particular, if any party feels that they are going to be irreparably damaged unless that they are able to receive immediate temporary emergency relief from a court, we can't issue that relief. But any party that feels that way is welcome to go to a court to receive that relief, because a court has the ability to grant it, as long as they state to the court that if there needs to be any substantive adjudication of the issues, then we wanted to litigate any substantive type of litigation in front of the Beis Din. But just for the temporary relief, we're turning to the civil court. So as long as it's in that context, we're not, you know, giving this particular remedy to any particular person. We would say this to anybody. And as I said, ideally it should even be listed on the website. It's an if-then. Similarly, it's an if-then with respect to somebody who feels that they need to go to the criminal courts because they feel that they're being abused or threatened by somebody. We say, if there is a real threat in your mind, that you feel that you are about to be abused or you're in a dangerous situation, then the halakha permits you to turn to the criminal authorities for protection. This way, we're not judging the other party, because we don't have the ability to judge the other party, but we're simply broadcasting to the one who turned to us what their halakhic rights are. So if the other party then comes to us and says, I don't respect or I can't possibly defer to the judge Besdin anymore because you have prejudicially ruled against me because I wasn't hurting my wife at all. She just wants to, you know, get leverage against me in our divorce case by filing for an order of protection. We say, we're not judging anything. We're saying, if then, we can't, you know, possibly deny somebody their privilege of seeking police protection if they feel that they're really in danger. But we're not saying that we definitely know one way or another. That's why we have to frame the answer in an if-then context. But it's very, very important, never in an ex parte context, to take somebody completely at their word, to just prejudge the other individual. You could say it in an if-then context, if it's the type of thing where a person has the right to utilize the court system for purposes of emergency relief. And again, if it's in a civil context, the ultimate litigation, the underlying substantive litigation would have to be in front of the Besdin. Okay, we have, at this point in time, 4 minutes left. So let's start number five. In an action for the enforcement of a real estate contract and deed by the purchaser, it emerges that the deed was never recorded in the land records of the state of Illinois. Should that have any bearing on the Besdin's decision? So both with respect to questions 4 and 5, in this Wall Street article of May 12, 2006, this Wall Street Journal that they asked me to write, because at the time, there was the Satmar community was having a major fight over which Rebbe would be taking over the movement, whether it would be the Rabbi Moshe Teitelbaum had passed away, and there was a question about which one of the sons was going to take over the Malchus. You may recall what ended up happening. It was a big fight, and they split, okay? So it all worked out for everybody, right? I think one in Monroe, one in Williamsburg, something like that. So they asked me to write an article at the time, and I said, I am not going into the particulars of this dispute because that would be unsavory. But I don't want to turn down an opportunity to write an article. So therefore, I started with a little bit about the situation without saying anything, and then I just spoke about Besdin in general. So, in the course of the discussion, I even had the temptation. See, they came up with the title, When a Jew Sues, and then somebody sent me an email saying, oh, that sounds like Jew Sues, and don't you know that's anti-Semitic? It wasn't my title. But I was actually thinking of coming up with a particular title. I was going to write the Royal Teitelbaums, which I thought would be like a cute title. But then I thought, no, because that also is like bringing out attention to this particular family. So even though that would have been a really clever title, I stayed away from it, just for the record. So anyway,
what was your title?
What? I think I just told them to pick a title. I don't remember. I may have had a title, but I don't remember.
So the copyright what? Issues if you did the royal title.
Nah. Okay, maybe. I don't know. So I mentioned a couple of these issues. If you take a look, for example, at paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so we say we need to ascertain whether there is a need to submit to Besdin. Okay? If one party says no, Besdin may issue a contempt order against that party, which would typically be accompanied by official permission for Reuven to take the matter to civil court. Besdin may also authorize Reuven to pursue emergency injunctive relief in civil court. For example, if it were alleged that someone was about to sell the house and have the proceeds put in a Swiss bank account, Besdin could authorize Reuven to pursue the freezing of Simon's assets until an agreement has been reached by both parties to submit their dispute to the jurisdiction of a Besdin. Now, of course, in actual practice, as I mentioned, it's much better to just tell the person to go to court to seek that relief unless they've already signed the Shtar Berurin in front of the Besdin. But let's say that we're talking about a real estate dispute. So if you take a look at the second paragraph on the right side, it said they wanted to, Simon and Reuven could ask the Besdin to decide their matter in accordance with local law. So if, for example, the deed was valid, we're talking about deed, whether a person received valid deed to a property, but the transfer of property from father to son was not properly recorded in a public registry as required by secular law, then the Besdin might find in favor of Reuven, even though Shimon had received the deed of the property under dispute from the father. So this is along the lines of this question. Let's say there is a deed to property that is conveyed from Reuven to Shimon, but it's never recorded in the land records. So here it's important to note that there was a major dispute among poskim in Europe, because there, if the taboo, if a land sale was not recorded in the taboo, then it was considered to be null and void. And there were poskim who said that since there's a mindset that everybody knows that when you transfer land, you have to do so in accordance with the customs of the society and the laws of the society, even if it's not required according to halakha, if you didn't register in the taboo, then it's not considered to be a valid sale. It happens that in America, there are lawyers here who can confirm this, the registering in the land records just is a way of being able to protect your title from subsequent purchasers. But if, as far as the objective validity of a sale is concerned, if somebody received a deed to a property but did not file that deed in the land records, it still is considered to be a valid sale, and therefore the laws will be somewhat different. What I'd like to discuss next time is how the mere fact that there's an expectation of filing a deed in land records might affect adverse possession law according to halakha, and I'd like to discuss some of the distinctions between adverse possession law in secular law and adverse possession law in halakha, and how that plays out in 3 weeks in Yom Tov.
Yeah, just real quick. When you have an injunctive relief or the order of protection, does the Beis Din subsequently allow, when they actually come before the Beis Din, for the party to mention that they had obtained such an order by the court? Or is that considered prejudicial?
No. We need to know the entire procedural history of the case. It's not prejudicial. It's very important. We need to know that.